The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Hey, gang, I want to thank you for listening to this episode of How Did I Get Here? I know you have a lot of choices out there, and the fact that you're listening to this episode right now is not lost on me, so thank you. I'm not sure what platform you're listening on, but whatever platform you're on, give us a follow. And if you like what you hear, leave us a rating. It takes just a second, and it means the world to me. Plus, it really helps the show. So thank you in advance. And remember, the last 100 episodes of How Did I Get Here are available on all streaming services. Now, enjoy the show.
And you may ask yourself, well, how did I get here?
It's time for How Did I Get Here? And now here is your host.
I'm Johnny. I'm your host. Welcome to the show, gang. I'm back. Last Sunday, I tested positive for COVID. I spent a week feeling like shit, and now I'm back, baby. I'm feeling good today. Hopefully, it'll last all day. I felt good a couple of days during the COVID and got out and started kind of doing some stuff, got up and started like moving around and getting shit done. And then by the afternoon, I was totally wiped out. Maybe that'll still happen for a few days, but I'm feeling good now. I'm telling you that, man. Woof. I made it through the COVID. Got to give a shout out to my dog, Rosie. She said, last time I had COVID was in 2022, and she was only a year and a half old then. And she was a total pain in the ass. She was really hard to deal with. She was so hard to deal with that I talked to my aunt about giving her away because I was like, man, if I can't even get sick with this crazy dog, like it's very hard to be, you know. And now she's grown up. She's matured. She's a lot cooler. She's done a great job of being my dog this week. So, yeah. I haven't done a lot this week except like watch a bunch of shit on TV, listen to a bunch of music, postpone a bunch of emails, reschedule a bunch of podcasts. So all that's done. It's all going down and we're back. I am back. And gang, I have a great show for you guys today. That's right, man. New Orleans based singer, songwriter, guitar hero, Anders Osborne is my guest on the show today, gang. Yeah, that's right, man. He was born in Sweden. But in his travels as a teenager, he came to New Orleans. He fell in love with it and ended up staying there until now. He's been there the whole time, man. We have a really fantastic conversation. He has a brand new record out. It's his 17th record. Just came out on Friday. Amazing record called Picasso's Villa. Get out there and check it out. We have a really fantastic conversation about that. Now, he made this record with a producer that's worked with Neil Young and Joni Mitchell and also plays drums. His name's Chad Cromwell. But he brought in the legendary guitar player, Waddy Wachtel. If you know who he is, you know who he is. If you don't, man, that's the guy that like co-wrote Werewolves of London and played guitar with Stevie Nicks and I mean, everybody. Bob Glaub plays bass, another legendary bass player guy. They made this fantastic record that leans more into Anders' rock and roll sensibilities. Like Anders is a singer-songwriter. Anders has these kind of like reggae kind of songs that are out there that are very popular of his. But he also has a rock and roll side. And that's what he's expressing. That's the muscle he's flexing on Picasso's Villa. We have a really great conversation about getting sober, about how meditation keeps him sane, about how he's gone through this period of refocus and renewal. And this record, Picasso's Villa, is really a reflection of that. We talk about this birthday bash that just happened on Saturday night, on May 4th in New Orleans at the Civic Theater. This was a sold-out, huge show. Talk about him being homeless. And you know what I mean? Talk about him turning his life around and getting his shit together. Also working with Austin favorites, South Austin Moonlighters. He produced their record, Travel Light. Really great conversation. He's an award-winning dude that's won like best guitar player 3 years in a row in New Orleans and best songwriter 2 years in a row in New Orleans, won Entertainer of the Year in New Orleans. You can catch him on tour. He'll be on tour of the East Coast May 15th through May 30th. Go to AndersOsborne.com for all of your Anders Osborne needs. Also, his dear old friend, Tabwen Benoit, who he's produced a couple of records for, they'll be doing a tour together in July and August. Now, this is a really good conversation, but I must say there are a couple of technical difficulties. I went in and I fixed them as best I could, but at about 37 minutes, we lose the right channel with Anders, and you just get him in the left channel for the end of the conversation. He was shopping. He was out doing some stuff with his wife while we did this conversation. So I lost him a couple times and fixed it. But that last couple of minutes, it's just in the left channel. But still a great conversation. Still a fantastic dude. We connected. Even though he was out there doing stuff, man, I could tell he was like stopping, thinking about what I was asking him, like, oh shit, man, we're engaging. So this is me and singer, songwriter, guitar player, guitar hero, Anders Osborne. Let's get down.
Prepping for Jazz Fest. We got to pick up a few things. I've had rehearsals and interviews, and now my son is coming in. He and his girlfriend are driving in from out of town. So we're like, oh, we need to go pick up some stuff before they show up. So that's where we're going.
Sure. are they coming in for the big birthday bash?
That too. Yeah, my son's going to work with me. He's going to help me crew a little bit with the rest of my guys.
Fantastic, man.
Yeah.
Well, congratulations on this record, Picasso's Villa. What a gorgeous record.
Thank you. And it's,
I feel like it's, are you feeling like a little bit more rock and roll these days?
Yeah, I think there's been a return to that side. I come in and out of it. I go a little folky, and then I go a little R&B-ish or New Orleans-y. And then I return to kind of my roots from time to time. And I think it's been that direction for a minute.
Yeah. You know? It still feels really great. That is that Chad Cromwell who played drums on it?
Yeah.
I mean, you got, these are like, you have Waddy Wattel and Bob Glaub. Did you guys, were you guys able to all cut together?
Yeah, we did a record prior to this one called Buddha and the Blues, and we went to Ojai, and that's kind of where I made a connection with Waddy. I hadn't really worked with him before. And then I brought the same guys to New Orleans for this one. And so we were all together for a few days and tracked, and then we overdubbed a little bit for a few days. So it was great.
Yeah, it really, like every song, it just feels so good. Like the groove on every song is just so deep and so fantastic.
Love it. Thank you.
Yeah, man, for sure. We have some mutual friends. You did a record for some friends of mine, the South Austin Moonlighters, their Travel Light album.
Yeah,
man.
Lovely.
That's been a bit. Do you do a lot of producing or?
Yeah, I go, like it comes in waves.
Right.
And every once in a while, I had a few years where I did a ton of it. And then I didn't really feel like I was doing a great job. I was doing too many. So then I took a break. I just started to pick it back up a little bit again. But yeah, the last, I guess all through my career, there'll be a year or two where I do maybe 5 to 15 records I produce. And then I take a little break.
Shit, that's a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. I probably produced way over 100 records. So that, yeah, I like doing it.
That's amazing. are you working with anyone right now? You were saying you might be
Yeah, I got a few. Tab Benoit's new one. I've done a few for him, and I'm part of that. And what was the one I just did? What was I just producing? You remember when I was just working? Asking my wife. there are a few local things. But what the heck was it? Oh, Sam. I'll think of it before the podcast is over. I did, right now, I finished a couple of years ago. Railroad Earth is an Americana band that's really cool. I worked on their record. Who else did I work? There's someone I'm working on right now, and I can't believe I'm spacing it. Like, I'm in the middle of it. It's freaking me out.
That's all right. That just means you're busy.
Oh, my goodness. That is embarrassing. Who am I working with? Okay, we'll get back to that.
Sure. So, man, how long have you been in New Orleans?
Next year, I think it'll be 40.
Okay.
40.
And so,
yeah.
Like, did you, you were born in Sweden, and you, how long were you there?
I was about 16, and then, yeah. And then I did a little bit of hitchhiking and, like, you know, free-form travel, so to speak. I just kind of improvised for a couple of years. And then I ended up in New Orleans when I was 17-ish. Yep.
And what was it? I mean, obviously, New Orleans attracts people, and they are like magnets. But, like, what was it for you that...
A combination of two things. One was a friend that I had met in Dubrovnik and traveled with for a little bit. He lived there and invited me. And then as I got there, obviously it clicked, and it was it's a unique, as you know, just a sensational, different type of place. But it's also, it's like, I don't know, it's just easy to live here in many ways. And then there's also other aspects, you know, just family and things like that.
Yeah.
Are you out of Austin?
I am in Austin, yeah.
I love it up there. It's a great town.
Yeah, it is a great town. It seems like a town that would welcome you. It has,
I hope,
right?
So.
Yeah,
I'm
yeah.
Pretty nice.
So, when you were traveling and you were 16, how long had you been playing music at that point? And did you know this was what you wanted to do?
No, not really. It was like music was more of a personal thing. Like I liked writing. I was writing poetry, and I discovered kind of compositional stuff, playing a pump organ at the house. And I really liked, you know, things I could make myself feel something by playing these different melodies. Then I got a guitar. I was probably 9, something like that. But I don't think the transition into making it my job happened until my 20s. I had lived and worked in New Orleans for probably 5-6 years.
What were you doing for work?
I did all kinds. I was a roadie, dishwasher, helping in kitchen, waiter. I worked at a horse farm up in Folsom, like an hour and a half from New Orleans. What else did I do? All kinds of stuff. Roofer. The transition was I played all the time, and like my passion was to write songs. And then I would check them out and try to get some kind of feedback at Jackson Square. So I would sit on the streets, on the square. I used to do the same in New York or Athens or wherever I was. And you'd play. And then someone said, you should go play over there at that bar. And then you go play at an open mic night, or you get a gig, or you try to get a gig. And eventually, I think the ambition bug got me a little bit. And I kind of realized it was hard for me to do regular jobs. I just couldn't get into it. And all I thought about was writing and playing. So I was probably about 23 where I made the decision to stop all my day gigs and just focus on trying to play enough to make a living. And that's when I made that decision.
So what did that look like? Like restaurant gigs and like 4-hour gigs in the corner of a place?
Yeah, it was a lot of Bourbon Street, yeah. 11 sets, you know, from sure. club to club. You worked from 11 a.m. to 4 a.m. some days. It was hard work. Yeah.
Right, but that's probably what molded you into the player that you became, right?
I think so. I think it's important to play a lot, both for the attention, but also to play and not get attention, to just play and be used to like crowds around you so you can be comfortable and feel natural and relaxed in the environment of public spaces. If you always try to put on a show, I think it can deter you from playing live. Because I have a lot of performance anxiety. I wouldn't say stage fright, but I'm not like, it's not my favorite. I'm more of an introvert, so it's uncomfortable. But I'm comfortable playing in public, if that makes any sense.
That makes
sense,
yeah.
And I think that comes from... I think those jobs train me to just play and don't worry so much about it. Some people are really good at entertainment and they're more like performers. So they need the performance and the show and they do a great job doing that stuff. But I think for me, it was important to just play in the bar, piano bars, you know, tourist traps, restaurant, happy hours, all that stuff.
Yeah. And you grow exponentially as like the Beatles in Hamburg, you know, I don't even know how long it was that they did that, but they grew exponentially in that time.
I think you do too. All you need is a year or two, I think, where you really have to grind it every week.
Yeah.
And it'll change a lot. If you do it too long, I think you can get stuck and you got to be careful not to burn out on it too.
Right. So
maybe, yeah.
So was that was like the mid-80s that you started doing that?
Yeah. So at first it was just regular jobs. But so I would say late 80s, 88, 89. I think I made the switch in 89 to make it my job. That would put me at, I'm born 66. Yeah, that put me at 23.
Okay.
That makes about right. Yeah, makes sense.
How long was it before you made a record? Was your first record that one that came out in 1994?
No, the first one was in 1989. It's called Doing Fine. And it was made here in New Orleans. It was a music store owner and a great piano player, John Otan, had a little local label called Rabidash Records. And he would put out people like me and just, you know, George Porter, another lady called Nora Wickstead, Al Broussard, which was the last living piano player from the Storyville era.
Oh, wow.
Like the original story. Yeah. He was like 8 or 10 years old. He used to be in those brothels and learn how to play piano. And so he had at the Trico House. That's where I used to play too. Anyway, so John picked me up and helped get me gigs and made a record with me. And we had George on there. And I remember Peter Erskine was playing drums.
Oh, wow.
A local guy, great drum.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, it was, you know, it was my first attempt to my own record. So some of it's good, some of it's okay. But it was fun. I got to be... you know, in the center of that whole thing. And it was a good experience to learn how to behave amongst a lot of really good players and try to hold my own, you know?
Right, right. There is a certain sort of unspoken code where you have to be somewhat cool to hang. Not just able to play, but you also can't be an asshole.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, if it's... I had, during that session, actually, an engineer, that's an interesting comment you made, because this engineer, really, really successful engineer at the time, and I was trying to make this guitar solo work out and I kept messing it up, this part. And I had a big explosive outburst, very childlike. And he pulled me aside outside the studio, and he's like, "Hey, not trying to tell you what to do, but just remember, your energy is the central energy, and it affects all of us."
Well, wow, what a great way to put
it. Very sweet and subtle. So we need you to guide the energy. So just keep that in mind. I got you. I'm sorry. And it was very subtle, but he nudged me back into just stay cool, man. If you're going to do this, stay cool.
Yeah.
It was good.
As a producer, have you ever shared that with any of the people that you were working with?
Yeah, absolutely. You have to. Sometimes you don't have to speak it. You can just body language and
sure.
You can direct people to go out. Like, there's ways to do it, but you try to do the work as much as you can pre-production so that the people that show up, they're already good together, so to speak.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You've done your homework. You know, one guy is, he's funny.
Yeah.
He cracks everybody up. So you got to have him. You have someone that's kind of a downer. You got to make sure that he has a counterpart. You know, you got to make sure that the crew, you know who you got with you.
Yeah, dude, that's super important. So did you get to tour on that first record at all? Like, did you go out on the road in support of anybody else after you made it?
Not a ton, but I mean, John was really helpful. He was the guy to set up. So, you know, I would get a weekend in Orlando, or maybe we went to Jackson, Mississippi, and we opened up for Wet Willie for a minute. Johnny Winter. Yeah, I got a few things that, like, and then that led to something else. And then, but a lot of it is just back in those days. I think the key thing was to kind of, for me, set up something in New Orleans. And then during Mardi Gras, Jazz Fest, all these situations, you can gather fans from all over the country. They get to see you if you do a good job.
Yeah.
And then you might get hired to another festival in New Jersey, or, you know, there's some Tulane students that live up in Chicago. They bring you up for a private party.
Sure.
It just kind of spreads naturally from a town like, similar to Austin, I think, you know?
Yeah. There was something I wanted to ask you about, because in your career, I noticed that the kind of shows that you're able to play and the kind of people you're able to tour with, you're able to really cross a lot of, like, I saw you did a show with, like, I think it was Widespread Panic and Trey Anastasio Band. That's like a whole, like, jam world of stuff. And then at the same time, you're taken very seriously as a singer-songwriter, almost as an Americana artist. And you're able to sort of, like, walk through these genres and scenes pretty seamlessly.
I'm sure I stumble here and there, but I think part of that is that I don't see myself as specifically a style. I think I just try to perform. I don't know. I don't think I try to perform in any way. I think it's just moods, and these different styles, sometimes they fit me at different times. You know, a lot of the music that goes on in New Orleans is kind of based on improvisation.
Right.
And that falls in the jam band scene quite easily. So you can, the Grateful Dead scene showed up when I was the most outside playing, when we improvised, you know, one song for 18 minutes, and it was just almost chaotic. That's when they started showing up.
Right. So you have dabbled in the jam world yourself.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I toured for probably 5 years with Phil Lesh, and it was a lot of improvising.
Oh, wow, man. That's awesome. I bet you learned a lot from somebody like that as far as, like, about playing.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
yeah, I think also just odd chord progressions and structures. I mean, just phenomenal stuff.
It's interesting. How did that end up informing your own music, like coming from a gig like that for 5 years?
Well, I think there's a sense of freedom that they allow themselves.
Uh-huh.
And there's a sense of when it falls under the category of I've heard it before, they make an attempt to see if there's another solution, progression-wise, chord-wise, sometimes, you know, meter-wise. So when I left, or when I stopped going out there playing with Phil a little bit, I could tell that my songs would go from, like, you know, a G, D, A major, B flat, major seven, back to C major seven, F, C, D, back to the G. Like, all of a sudden you start, and then you search for where's this going to take me melodically.
Right.
And something new would just kind of crack out of it. And I'm like, this is great. Because it's not jazz. It's just searching.
Right.
It's not classical. It's not more or less advanced. It's just a different way of letting your brain be more free. Go anywhere and see what happens. It's just a lovely experience. And that also allowed the songs to be like less predictable.
Right. Right. That's interesting, because then you're still able to write a song that has hooks and has makes sense to the listener in a way, but you're still able to make it interesting. Like, you know the parameters. You're not making it. You're not doing any 18-minute jams right now, or putting them out at least.
Totally. Yeah, there's definitely, and there's a folk music element to, I think, what they're doing. That's really interesting.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about meditation. When did you get into that?
That was originally it was probably about 35 years ago, but because of, you know, just the different lifestyle, and especially the drinking and the drugging, a lot of that stuff wasn't real for many years. I would say the sincere effort showed up around 13, 15 years ago. Like, I had gotten sober, and maybe a year or two had lapsed, and I started to really pay attention to all these different, you know, techniques and different things that you need to do to dismantle your ego and find that serenity and equanimity inside, you know, so you can handle life a little better. And maybe one of these lifetimes, you get to stop the karmic cycle. Who knows?
So was it years on the road and like just being in bars that led you to drinking and drugging like that?
I think that's one of the reasons. I think another one also is just I learned in my early teens, but that was a very quick way to be comfortable in my own skin, not worry about my insecurities or how to self-medicate if there was any trauma. Yeah, so I'm saying, I think the quick switch into, or going from feeling uncomfortable, insecure, or any sort of social anxiety or whatever, it was a quick step into, hey man, everything's great. I'm good, or I don't care, and social lubricant, all that good stuff. Just a normal thing. But then I think it became also habitual, and then it became my go-to for any kind of experience, you know, whether it was up, past trauma, new experiences that were difficult to deal with or anything. And it just became habitual. And then being in the music business, I think they went hand in hand in the culture of entertainment. It kind of, I think it promotes intoxication as much as possible. But yeah. And after a while, I just realized that it was all over. You know, I lost everything and I was homeless and it didn't work.
Oh. Man, that's a blur. And so you got yourself together?
No, it was with the help of other people. They scooped me up. I was, at the time, I was living in the park here, a few blocks from my house, and I've been there for about a year. And I got one more shot, and they had gotten me into a rehab, and I said yes. It stuck. This time, it worked, and I've been sober since. Yeah, I got lucky. I had some sort of awakening and a psychic change at the end of the rehab that time, and I don't know, something just shifted and I got it. I realized that that's it for me. I'm done. And I want to be sober. I want to be clear headed and pure, just like the rest of nature, you know, like the trees, the clouds.
Yeah.
I don't know why I was trying to be intoxicated every moment when everybody else around me or everything is so pure what I'm doing.
Right.
That's kind of how it felt.
That's amazing that you were able to come out of that and live through it, you know?
Yeah.
Get the wake-up call.
Lucky. Very lucky.
Yeah. It probably made you a better father.
I don't know if I was even a father prior to that, but yeah. I mean, it's been a really learning experience to get sober and to, you know, every day, even with my wife, got to watch, be more mindful about everything and learn how to be a
real person.
A graceful.
Yeah.
Be a real person. Yeah.
Yeah. It's hard because, you know, outside of even that in music, it is difficult to be a real person because half of your job is not being a real person. Then you get into a life when you're on tour where your whole life revolves around the hour to 2 to 3 hours that you're not a real person. You know what I mean? It's so weird.
Very true.
The whole thing is a mind fuck. Yeah. And if you get off balance, it's hard to get back on balance, man.
Very much so.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Do you feel like it changed you as a songwriter?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think, especially lyrically, I think it just gave me a little more substance and honesty and a little more fearlessness. I mean, it just, I don't have anything to lose anymore by saying stuff. You just have to be honest and you have to honor the gods of music and poetry, and you have to make sure you pay attention and you say things that matter. You can't mess around. And if you mess around, it's got to be sincere, I guess. I think the motivation and intention behind the songs are true. I'm not saying they weren't before.
No, I know what you mean.
But I think there's a well of experience that I can draw from those, you know, all those years, that I think is helpful in my writing today. Yeah.
Yeah. What kind of writer are you? Are you like a daily writer? Are you
Pretty much. Yeah. I write all the time. Yeah. I use the voice memo for the ideas and guitars and melodies and stuff. And then notes, I write down lyrics, and then I give everything titles. And then I put it in categories of possible song clusters. Album clusters, so that they have a sort of a, almost like a fake deadline feel to it. Like, I got to get this and this. And then I also, by doing it so much, I don't have any specific pressure to finish songs. And that's one of the greatest strengths, I think, is to just keep moving forward.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's great. There was a song that there's a lot of, there's stories and points of view in these songs, but there's one song, Bewildered, that's kind of like your experience, I guess, in America. Is that what that is?
Yeah, it was my experience. The song was more about a hook, and the first line that came out of the first part was, I remember in the early 80s.
Yeah.
It made me think of, okay, so what do I remember from the early 80s? And once I opened that can of worms, you know, it was just interesting to see the things that were happening then, from the beginning of 24-hour news cycles to John Lennon to even the semi-automatic handgun was allowed in 1981 or 1982. And all of a sudden, the death rate at the ER in New York spiked overnight. The little things you can look at history and it changes everything. But now I got curious about the 90s and so forth. So I had to start Googling and looked at, you know, and I went down the rabbit hole. I was like, this is wild. And then it was 2019 and 2020 when I wrote it. And I went, wow, nothing's changed. That's wild.
Yeah. I don't mean to laugh, but yeah.
Yeah. But it is laughable. It's like, holy crap. It's just like the same. It's always the same.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
There's no, there's almost no, Bewildered is a great title for that song.
Yeah.
And these are all great songs. There was something that really struck me. There's kind of like this sort of like cinematic thing that happens towards the end of the last song, Le Grand Zombie.
Yeah.
How did you have that in mind before you recorded it, or how did you guys? Because that's really a beautiful and very cool sort of different thing than the other songs have.
Yeah, I did, but it was written on classical guitar. So the whole, it wasn't exactly that melody, but it was that chord progression that the strings are following. And then I had a melody that's sort of, it's close to what the strings are playing, the orchestra. But it wasn't powerful enough with just the nylon string. We broke it down and I played it on a Spanish guitar live, but it didn't quite work. It wasn't large enough. So then the producer, Chaz, that plays drums, he's like, I know this, my neighbor out in L.A., he works with a Romanian symphony, and he does this super cool stuff. He sent it to him and came back just, you know, amazing. I was super impressed.
Wow, yeah, it's beautiful. Let me ask you about Chad. Yeah. Like, when you look for a producer now, like, what is it that you need from a producer at this point in your development?
I think I got to have some sort of track record, knowing what they're doing. And most of the time I want it to be like they've done something and they've succeeded with something that I see as a, it's an accomplishment that I want. It's a sound that I've been hoping to achieve. It's a feeling. It's something they've done that's in their resume. And I like it to be mentors. Now, all these are not rules, but there's just the way I've been feeling. It's like there's a trust that I need because I see the music visually really pretty clearly. So I need someone that knows something I don't know to expand my vision when I make a record. They need to bring something I can't bring.
Correct. That's an interesting thing. Do you, have you produced yourself? I didn't really look in a lot of the history of who produced your records.
I have. And it's really difficult because there are moments where you only have your own knowledge and you can't really take it any further than what you know.
Right.
That means that you will stop at a point that may not be the full potential of the performance, the song, or the arrangement, but it's all I know.
Right.
So it'll just stop right there. If you have someone that you can truly trust, they'll get you to a place where they have hired the right bass player, the right engineer. All these things have been, my experience of musicality and my talent has reached its limits, so to speak. It's at a fence. Here comes the next experience. They take over, and now you expand the area. And that's how you grow and grow and grow. So you got to keep that. And sometimes you can stay with the same crew for 2 to 5 records. I think a few records is the greatest. Then you have to change engineer, studio. You have to change something that you can keep expanding for my own taste.
Right. So you're about to head out again on tour, and you're doing like a run of the East Coast. Is that like with a trio or with a duo?
It's a little mixture. There's some solo shows. Some of it depends on the venue and situation, you know, economics versus the place and the timing of availability. And some of them are a duo. I bring a saxophone on a couple. I bring a guitar player on some. Then we have a guitar, bass, and drums electric trio on a handful of it, too. So it's kind of a mixture of all things in May.
That's great, man. And then...
It's exciting.
You're doing a tour with Tab Benoit, who you've done some records with and stuff in July and August. That looks like that's going to be a lot of fun. You guys have done a lot of stuff together before, huh?
Yeah, I've known him since we were teenagers.
Wow.
And I've produced a couple of his things, and he's just such a tremendous talent. It's a treat to be around. We have a lot of fun together, laugh a lot, and so that's going to be a combination tour. We're on stage, both of us at the same time, with a backup band playing both our repertoires in one long set, and it's going to be great.
That's awesome. Hang on one second, Anders. Hang on. Okay, you there?
Yeah.
Sorry, I was losing a channel there. Well, man, this has been great talking to you, and this record is really gorgeous. You did a fantastic job, and I'm glad we were able to connect. It looks like you're at the world's most beautiful plant market.
It's insane.
Yeah. Look at that. Gorgeous, man. Well, dude, this has been great talking to you, and people should get out there and get this record. Are you planning on coming to Austin anytime on this tour?
Not the one in May, but we definitely got it. I haven't been to Texas in a long time, and I'm due to give that a shot and see if there's a crowd out there.
Yeah,
so,
man.
Yeah, I hope so.
Well, I'll definitely make it out if I'm in town and come out and see you and say hi.
That'd be great. I'll reach out before I show up.
Yeah, it's been a real pleasure, like, digging into your music. I've heard of you for a long time. I remember when those guys came on the show, when you did that record with them, I went back and listened to some of your stuff because he's a huge fan. But yeah.
Mm. Yeah, they're sweet, wonderful guys.
Yeah, man. Well, congratulations. Picasso's Villa is the album. Get out there and check it out. Go to AndersOsborne.com. See him if he's coming to a town near you. He'll be on the East Coast between May 15th and May 30th and on tour with Tab Benoit in July and August. Thank you, brother.
All right, buddy. Thank you. See
Thanks,
you.
Man. Bye. Yeah, gang, that's Anders Osborne. Sorry about that end there where it just gets on the left side. Sorry, technical difficulty, and I could not fix it. I hope you guys enjoyed that conversation. I sure did, man. Anders Osborne is a great musician, great artist, great songwriter. Check out his newest record, Picasso's Villa. It's available out there. It just came out last Friday. Go to AndersOsborne.com. Find out if he's coming to a town near you. And gang, while you're out there checking out AndersOsborne.com, don't forget that you can subscribe to this podcast wherever it is that you find podcasts, be it Spotify, Overcast, TuneIn, Apple Podcasts, new shows every Tuesday, every Friday. This week, 3 shows this week. Yeah. And a very special one coming out on Friday, gang. You know what I'm saying. We were so in vice in the dance hall days. You know what I'm saying, baby? Wang Chung. Wang Chung on Friday show. All right, gang, get out there and check out Anders Osborne's album, Picasso's Villa, and go to AndersOsborne.com for all of your Anders Osborne needs. Have a great week. Check out the show on Wednesday. I'll be talking to Austin Supergroup, the handsomest band in Austin, baby, Madam Radar. All right, gang, let's get down.
Convictions are strong, you like your choice.